and it's called Coming Out as a Spiritual Experience. So I think we can roll the tape. Good evening, everybody. I want to welcome you tonight. Very pleased that you have joined us for this series of discussions. And I also want to take this opportunity to thank Holden Village for giving us the chance to meet with you and talk with you and share our lives with you. This evening is called Coming Out as a Spiritual Experience. And we'll be talking about what that means in a moment, sharing a bit of each of our stories so that you get a chance to know who we are. My name is Ruth Frost, and I'm here with my colleagues, Phyllis Zilhart.
Hello.
And Jeff Johnson.
Hi.
The three of us work with Voice and Vision Lutheran, Lesbian, and Gay Ministry, which is a ministry in the San Francisco Bay Area by and on behalf of gay and lesbian persons. We are also on the pastoral staff of two congregations in San Francisco. Jeff is on staff as assistant pastor at First United Lutheran Church, and Phyllis and I are on staff as pastors at St. Francis Lutheran Church in San Francisco. So we spend about 25% of our time working with those congregations and about 75% of our time developing a ministry by and on behalf of gays and lesbians that affirms and nurtures and advocates for the lives and relationships of gay and lesbian people. What we're going to be doing tonight is taking, each of us will take 10 minutes to share our story with you, just again so that you can get to know us. And then the remainder of that time will be spent opening up this first evening's session to your questions. And I want to call your attention to the grease board here. I've listed, in order to enhance the atmosphere of trust and mutual disclosure and understanding, I've listed some ground rules that we ask that we agree on together to make this an environment where we can really be honest with one another and yet respectful about our differences. And so I just want to walk through them for a second. The first one is we expect that everyone here will address one another with respect, all the participants with respect. Certainly, personal attacks are not appropriate. Secondly, we ask that you use appropriate language. You can use the term lesbian or gay or homosexual, any one of those that seem comfortable to you. Lesbian and gay are terms that the lesbian and gay community use to define ourselves. Homosexual is a term that heterosexual persons tend to use to define us. We ask that you take turns with your questions and comments, and in the interests of giving everyone an opportunity who wants to participate, we'll call on you, keeping in mind gender parity, so that we're hearing equally from men and women. And we'll return, if you want to make a couple of comments or questions, you're free to do that after others have had their chance to comment or question. All questions asked in good faith with a willingness to learn are valid questions. All questions asked in good faith with a willingness to learn are valid questions. I also need to add that we reserve the right to decline to answer questions which we experience as inappropriate. That does not mean that if we decline to answer one of your questions that you've asked a terrible question. It may simply mean that it's a more appropriate question to pursue with you privately. When making statements, if you want to make a statement rather than ask a question, feel free to do so, but please limit your statements to 2 minutes, simply so that other people also get a chance to ask questions and make statements. And I'm expecting that these ground rules are going to work just fine, but I need to say that if we have a problem with the rules, if there's somebody in the room that continues to violate these rules, we'll have to terminate the conversation and ask you to leave. And that's only in the interest of creating an atmosphere which is safe for everybody. Just, do you have any questions about the ground rules before we begin? Okay. Well, then I want to... Yeah. January 20th of 1990, two Lutheran congregations took a daring risk. They called Jeff and Phyllis and me to be on their pastoral staff to do this ministry to lesbians and gay men. They did this because they saw it as an issue of conscience and justice, and they became aware of the fact that gay men and lesbians are either ignored in the church or often excluded from the church. One of the congregations is a very mixed congregation ethnically and racially, and really had had to struggle with the issue of justice on behalf of persons of color, and saw justice on behalf of gays and lesbians as an extension of that. The congregation is predominantly heterosexual. The other congregation, the congregation which Phyllis and I serve at, is located in the Castro District, which is a heavily gay and lesbian populated area of San Francisco. And it was a Danish Lutheran congregation that realized that they were not ministering to the people in their own community, and they wanted to change that. So they decided to become very welcoming and affirming of lesbians and gay men, and advertised in local periodicals, and then eventually came to the decision that they needed to call a lesbian pastor. Phyllis and I are their lesbian pastor. We interviewed for the position together as a couple, and they hired us as a couple, splitting that position. The congregations were put on ecclesiastical trial July 7th of 1990 by the Sierra Pacific Synod and the ELCA. The result of that 3-day trial was that they were suspended from the ELCA for a period of 5 years, and if the policies of the Lutheran Church, which prohibit gay and lesbian people from ordination unless we take a lifelong vow of celibacy, are changed, the suspension will end in expulsion from the ELCA for these two congregations.
Automatically,
it will convert to expulsion. We'll talk more about that in some of our later sessions, but I want to get on now with tonight's topic, which is coming out as a spiritual experience. And I neglected to say that Phyllis is my life partner as well as my colleague. So Phyllis, would you take it from here?
My name is Phyllis Zilhart. As I think of the heart of the gospel, the heart of the gospel as it has been true to my life, and I think we all experience some dimension of that most personally. For myself, that has always been the dimension of acceptance and belonging. And so in that sense, my baptism has always been very important as a symbol of God's claiming of me and therefore my acceptance. And Christian community has been important to me. I'll tell you a little bit about when I was growing up. As a child, we were all born into families that have constellation of dynamics that we may or may not understand. And in my family, what I was living with was that my father was an active alcoholic and my mom was a pretty wounded survivor of incest. Well, I didn't understand that, or we didn't talk about it, but it impacted my life quite a bit. And I realized that home was a pretty crazy place, and a place that I didn't like to be, and would try to get out of the house doing things as much as I possibly could. And for me, most of that time then meant that I wanted to be at church. And I found that the physical house that I was raised in was very chaotic. And so the house of God became very important for me, and a sense of who knows me, who understands me, who claims me and really wants me. And the only answer that felt big enough for me as I was growing up, even as a little child, I think, was God. You know, that God is the one who claims me and wants me. And I think that that really impacted my sense of Christian community, because that sense of belonging was then very important to me, that this is, in some ways, my family of choice, the family of God, this church community. And I think forgiveness, you know, is certainly a part of reconciliation. Transformation, I think, is salvation over time. But acceptance and belonging were really the heart for me. But as I was growing up, there were really two realities in my life that were both very true as I look back on them. One was that from my earliest memory, I wanted to be a pastor. Mm-hmm. And I remember that in vacation Bible school, at like 6, 7 years old, the teacher was going around asking, well, what did we want to do when we grew up? And I said, well, I wanted to be a pastor. And she kind of looked at me. This was before we were ordaining women. And she said, well, girls couldn't be pastors, but they could be parish secretaries. That was almost the same. Well, no offense to parish secretaries, and it's probably more true than I knew, that there is lots of ministry that secretaries, parish administrators do, but I thought, even at the time, it's not true. They're not the same, and that wasn't what I wanted to do. At the same time, I think now I can look back at my life, and as early as 6 years old, I can see clues that I was this budding lesbian. And I didn't really fully understand that until I was in my early 20s. But as I look back, I see those realities, and I was very much a tomboy and really identified with that. And as I look back, I had attractions to girls and older girls and younger women kind of throughout that whole time, but I dated men and tried to fit in all of that. So that as I look back on my life, I see both of those realities. The heart of this Christian experience in which from an early age I felt called to ministry, and as I look back, the heart of my embodied experience as a female, which was a female attracted sexually and romantically to other females. So both of those were very true. I couldn't look at it and say, well, one is true and one isn't, or which one is real, because they both very much had their own integrity in my life. But as I got older, and it really wasn't until I was unhappily searching in seminary that I began to realize that I needed to fess up to some things about my life, and one was that I was a lesbian. And I think coming out to myself was probably the hardest part of all. I think coming out to other people later was difficult, but the hardest was to look myself in that mirror. And I think it was the heart of the gospel as I experienced it that got me through that, because it was finally saying, you know, other people may reject me and other people may not know what to do with this part of myself, and I may have to give up this vision of parish ministry, but the heart of the gospel as I believe it is that I'm accepted by God and that this is who I am. And so it was that reality that God is with me and will sustain me that gave me the courage to begin to come out to myself, and then little by little to come out to other people, and finally to my family, and finally to the church, and finally to pretty much the world. and I think that's been a very transforming kind of thing for me. I really feel like it has been a resurrection experience, that in many ways my life was pretty shut down. I was very compartmentalized. Through growing up in this family, I knew what it meant to try to put on an act, to try to cover up for this dysfunction in my family, and to experience one reality but try to show and live out a different reality. And as I saw that happening to myself spiritually and sexually, I mean, that was very much an experience of the alienation and fragmentation in the world and in myself. And so to integrate that and to claim that as the heart of the gospel for myself in terms of the lack of alienation and isolation for myself was very, very liberating and very much an experience of new life, of resurrection from that tomb. Of risking to step out on the faith that conquers death and fear. So coming out has been very transformative and very much a spiritual and gracious experience in my life.
You had an extra 2 minutes.
Well,
do you want to use that?
Well, I saw a cartoon once that I'll share with you. When I was born in 1947, there was no wise midwife or physician present to turn to my parents and say, congratulations, you have a lovely lesbian.
So my parents raised me as most parents raise their children, with the assumption that they had a heterosexual child, but they had all heterosexual children. I can remember at age 4 getting my first clue that I was different, that I didn't fit in. I liked wearing my daddy's neckties. At age 7, I remember being on the playground at school and noticing that a little kid on the playground had a pack of playing cards, and one side of the card was a picture of Marilyn Monroe in the buff, in a sort of come hither position. And he was making a killing selling these playing cards one at a time to the other little boys in the class. And I remember sidling over and thinking, ooh, this is kind of neat. And I realized that I wanted one of those cards. And I didn't have any way of explaining that to myself. And there certainly weren't, you know, I don't know where the other 10% little girls were at that point, but there wasn't anybody else hanging around doing that. And I got one of these cards from one of the other little boys. And I had it in my desk all day, and I thought it was so interesting. It was probably sort of this first kind of dawning awareness of female body. But I remember going home from school with this card and realizing I had to ditch this card. It would not be cool to bring this card in and show my mom. And it wouldn't have been cool to have brought up, you know, a card of a male and nude either to show my mom. But I share that experience with you because that was my first awareness of shame. Knowing that I needed to ditch the card. Now, I didn't have a language for that. But it was my first awareness that there was something odd, something different, something bad about my difference. And I think that a lot of gay and lesbian children have that experience as kids. They pick up language, shame language from school. You know, faggot, pansy, sissy, queer, whatever. And who wants to use shame language to describe your reality? You know, that's not very fun. And so most of us don't talk about our experience of being different, even though we get ridiculed for it quite early, and particularly gay boys. As I grew up as an adolescent, I began to read romance novels, and of course the only romance novels available to me were heterosexual romance novels. And I found myself identifying with the male in the books when he would kiss the heroine chastely at the end. I saw myself as kissing the heroine chastely at the end. Now, that didn't mean I wanted to be a man. It was, I just used the heterosexual model the best way that I could. You know, tried to fit into it. And for me, to fit into that model meant taking a male perspective to understand my attraction for women. Well, this was all underground. And I did the usual things that most gay and lesbian children do. I mean, we act as if. Because we pick up clues from our society that it's not okay to be our real selves. And so I acted as if. I mean, I dated in high school, I dated boys in high school, and I had, by the time I became a young adult, I became involved with a woman in my early 20s. And that relationship did not last long. It was very exhilarating because I was very much in love. But it didn't last long because we were both too shame-based for that to last. And we broke up, and each of us made resolutions never to be involved again with a woman. And when I was 27 years old, I decided I sort of had a what I would call lesbian panic, although at the time I would not have been able to utter the L word. And I decided that the only thing that would fix me, you know, I'd act as if as hard as I could, and it wasn't working. So the only thing that would fix me would be to get married heterosexually. So I did that. The irony is that I married a man who was doing exactly the same thing I was doing, trying desperately to fit in. And I hope to this day that he is happily gay. He was very unhappily gay at that time. The relationship lasted about 2 years, and it was very hurtful, very painful to each of us. And, you know, clearly didn't work. Well, I, like Phyllis, had always wanted to be a pastor, so I had that as my dream all through college. And I come from a family where I am now currently third-generation clergy. My dad was a seminary professor for years, taught over 2,000 of the Lutheran pastors in the ELCA, and his father was a Lutheran pastor who immigrated from Denmark. So I sort of come by it naturally. But when I wanted to be ordained, the Lutheran Church wasn't ordaining women. So that was out, and it went on the back burner. And it wasn't until after my marriage and divorce that I decided I would enter seminary. And part of my decision in entering seminary was the dream of parish ministry. The other part was a very strong resolve to shut myself down sexually and to put all my efforts into being spiritual. You know, just close the door on sexuality, because that just didn't work. It didn't work. And instead, you know, really live my life spiritually. The result of that is that I cut myself off, my head from my body. I was very intellectual. I was theologically gifted, bright, capable in my classes, but nobody knew me. Any kind of conversation that I would get into with classmates would be very one way. I was skilled at inquiry and asking questions, and I deflected any questions to me because it wasn't safe to be who I really was. Now, ironically, it was while in seminary that I met a lot of other women who were trying to make it in a predominantly patriarchal system where most of the professors were male and the majority of the student body was male. And so they would band together and kind of support one another. And in that process, we discovered that women's voices and women's experience aren't very well represented in our tradition, our Jewish Christian tradition. That our tradition has been told largely by males, for males, and about males, and that when women feature in the tradition, it's usually because they're affiliated with a man, married to a man, or the daughter of a man. And so we started to ask, how can we reclaim our voice as women in the Jewish Christian tradition? How can we find ourselves? And I think it was in asking that question that I eventually was led to saying, you know, my voice as a woman, I've had difficulty finding my voice as a woman in this tradition, and I have certainly had difficulty finding my voice as a lesbian. But the other thing that helped my process was that I met Phyllis in seminary my senior year. And we fell in love. We like to tease about the fact that we fell in love in preaching class. At the same time, I was having an interview out in New York City with the bishop of the New York City Synod, because I thought it would be a good idea to be a parish pastor in Manhattan, because if I couldn't keep my sexuality under control, at least there'd be support from other gays and lesbians. And I had an interview with him, and I was told ahead of time, don't come out to this bishop, Ruth, he's very homophobic. And we had an interview, and he was curious about my marriage, and he started asking me questions about it, and I told him half the truth, which was that I had married a gay man. And he said, you know, you will make a very fine minister to the women in my parishes who have been left by their gay husbands. And I thought, oh boy. And he welcomed me to the synod and said, you're, you know, really well qualified. We're delighted to have you in this synod. You know, all your references all checked out, etc. And we, after about a 3-hour interview, I left him and I left his office and I walked out onto the streets of Manhattan, Fifth Avenue, where the Lesbian and Gay Freedom Day parade was walking down Fifth Avenue. And it was a vivid illustration of the craziness of my life. Hundreds of thousands of people were marching and waving placards which said, I'm gay and I'm proud. And I stood there on the sidewalk, you know, just kind of stunned, thinking, there is no way I could say I'm gay in this church. And there is certainly no way that I could say I'm proud. Because to be in the church means to be absolutely closeted. You don't know who you can trust. You don't know when confidentiality will be broken. And to live a life of the closet is to live a life that is very, very costly. Because the closet means you have to keep secrets, and you have to tell lies, and you have to withhold yourself. And you cannot have intimacy. I got my 2-minute warning. And it also means that you can't tell anybody about your joy or your sorrow. You can't share what's important to you, and you begin to drift away from family as well as from other people you love. And so there's an old saying in the 12-step AA program, you're as sick as your secrets. And believe me, by then I was very, very sick, because I had been keeping secrets all my life. And so basically for me, the process of coming out in my senior year of seminary meant reclaiming myself as a woman and as a lesbian,
and as someone who did not need to be ashamed of who I am, but as someone who could actually begin not only to accept my difference, but to begin to celebrate it and to see it as a gift and a strength. And that was a really wonderful thing. And falling in love with Phyllis was a major part of that renewal for me. And also coming out to my family was a major part of that renewal. And that's another story. But we can share that sometime, some other time.
I was raised in Southern California as a Danish Lutheran. My grandparents, all four of them, emigrated from Denmark. And we were of the Happy Dane strand. I don't know if you know the Happy Danes and the Holy Danes. So we would sit around. The Holy Danes don't drink or play cards or really laugh a lot, as I have been led to believe by my Happy Dane grandparents. And the Happy Danes do all of those things and more. And we would sit around and, on holidays, we would sit around and tell stories, lots of stories, about the way life was back in the old country and the way life was here, and tell jokes and have traditions and have a really good time. And I grew up loving to tell stories. And I knew that someday I would be able to tell my kids, as my grandparents were telling their grandkids, the stories of their life. It wasn't until I got into my teens, early teens, when I realized that my story was going to be somewhat different from the stories that I had heard tell in my family. That my story was going to be perhaps even more difficult to tell, and I didn't know how to tell it. I had heard on the playgrounds of school lots of words to describe what it was that I was feeling, and I didn't like those words. When I told people that instead of playing baseball or football or basketball, I liked to bake with my grandma, I got called a sissy. And instead of doing all of the things that normal boys do, and I would do the things that not normal boys do, I got called queer or faggot or those types of things. But I didn't internalize that. I didn't know what that meant, except that it meant something bad. I remember at the same time that it wasn't very ambitious to think that you were going to grow up and become a baker. So that I had a couple of other options. I could grow up and become a lawyer, which was an occupation where there was some storytelling, or I could grow up and become a pastor. And it was really in the church, it was in this community of faith that I discovered a bunch of other storytellers. And I discovered this vital story that we told over and over and over and over again. And I would go back with my parents and my sisters and brothers to hear this story that is central to Lutherans and central to Christians, the story of the gospel being retold in all different kinds of ways. And I was fascinated, not only by the story, but by the way people told that story. And so very early on, I decided that, well, perhaps it was an option that I could go on and become a pastor. And so one of the ways to do that, since I was Lutheran, was to go and study German, because I had to be able to read the stories as they had been told in their original languages. So I studied German for 4 years in high school, and I studied German for 4 years in college, and I majored in German. And I finally had a language to talk about somebody else's spirituality, a spirituality that came out of a different century from mine, but I didn't have a language to talk about my own spirituality. Prior to that, there's a significant event that happened the first year of high school. I remember my confirmation. And it was kind of a pinnacle experience. It was right at the beginning of this whole process. And it was right at the beginning of my questions around, do I want to become a pastor? What do I want to do? And also lots of questions around sexuality and my sexual feelings that I was beginning to have. And I remember kneeling there before the altar. That was the ritual that the confirmands in my parish did. Kneeling there before the altar, praying. 2 weeks before that, I had had my first experience of self-sexual gratification. That's one of the ELCA bishops' ways of talking about masturbation. And for 7 years after that experience and my feelings of same-sex attraction between me and other boys and me and other men were the biggest sins that I had to confess. And as I sat there kneeling before God's altar, thinking about perhaps becoming a pastor someday in this church, I said, take this away. I can't do this. This is not something that is within my realm of possibility. This is not a story that I know how to tell. And it was not until 7 years and I have all of these different seminaries that I can choose from. I have a seminary in Minneapolis, and I have a seminary in the southern part of the United States, and I have a seminary in Gettysburg, but no. Let's choose the seminary in San Francisco so that I can also begin to ask some questions around my sexuality and begin to explore those questions. My dilemma at that point was, if this was real, if these feelings that I had been trying to deny and push under for the past 7 years were real, then sometime in the future I could anticipate some kind of conflict with my aspirations and my ambitions about becoming a pastor in a church that I knew had only a language of fear and sin and shame to talk about what I was experiencing very really in myself. I knew that I had been created. At the beginning, I knew that I had been created with a defect. But by this time, I had moved to the place where I could say, I had been created good, but I didn't really know what to do with that. And as I went on to seminary and entered seminary, I decided that I was going to find out what to do with it. So I started to date. I came out to myself. I came out to a few friends. I had a boyfriend, the guy who lived across the hall from me. Nobody in seminary knew that we were in a relationship. I came out to my parents. I came out to as many people in kind of a small circle around my life as possible. And I finally decided, it was then 2 years into seminary and it was time for internship. And I decided that I would go on internship and not really press this issue. I hadn't come to the place where I was proud enough and convinced enough of my own self-worth, where I could go to my parish and say I was a gay man and, this is just the reality of my life. So I went to internship and I had two distinct lives. I lived one life in the parish where I was a fine intern pastor, and I lived one life in the Sacramento gay community. The problem was that I sang at that time, and I chose to become involved with the Sacramento men's chorus. It wasn't the Sacramento gay men's chorus, that wasn't the title of it, but there were only gay men in the Sacramento men's chorus. So for all practical purposes, it was a gay men's chorus, and that's where I made connections in the gay male community and was very active politically in that part of town. I decided, though, one Sunday that I ought to try to have this wonderful group of men who were singing these songs into the parish to sing for a Sunday morning service. What a great idea, huh? To bring a group, the Sacramento Men's Chorus, into my parish where I was the intern pastor. We had the service, I preached, it was a great service, everybody loved it, they wanted the people back next year. And I thought, oh, it was a great success. So I was walking around afterwards through the pews of the church, just picking up bulletins and spare pieces of paper, and I came across a three-ring binder. And I picked it up because it was odd that there was a three-ring binder in the pews of the church, and I opened it up, and it was one of the binders from one of the men in the chorus. And on the front page of the binder as I opened it up was a song that was entitled The Homosexual National Anthem. And I thought, oh my God, what if somebody else in my parish picked this up? And what if somebody else made the connection between this national anthem and the 36 other men who were in this chorus and made the connection then with me? My world at that moment came crashing together. And I resolved that it was not possible to separate my life in the lesbian and gay community with my life in my parish. It was not possible to stand up in the pulpit and to talk about justice and justice love and to tell the story of the gospel without being able to tell my story. And so I resolved that when I returned to seminary to talk to my bishop, who was at that time Stan Olson of the LCA, to talk to him about my sexuality and to talk to him also about my process of certification, which was going to happen that fall, which I did. His response to me when I told him that I was a gay man was, well, why did you call me up? Why are we having this conversation? What's the big deal? And I said, well, I want to share this with my endorsement committee. He said, well, what's the problem? I'll let your endorsement committee know before you share it with them. I'll tell them that they only can talk about this for 10 minutes, and then they have to move on to more important issues, and we'll get on with life. This he did. I shared this with the committee. And in the fall of 1987, I and two other seminarians were certified for ordination by predecessor churches to the ELCA, certified with the full knowledge of the committee members that we were openly gay men, and certified without any of these policies which have developed now in the ELCA about celibacy and sexual abstinence and all of these kinds of things. I say this only because I think the story that we tell as Lutheran Christians is very important. And I think that the stories that the ALC and the AELC and the LCA were telling are stories which are different than the stories which we are hearing now in our church. And I don't like what I'm hearing. And I don't like what I experience or what people who are parts or a part of my community are experiencing. I think it's important that we talk today, and I think it's important that we share our stories and that we share our stories so that somehow we can get back on track. And so that somehow we can get back to that primary story that brought me to this place in the first place.
We'd like to open it up now to you to ask questions of us or make comments or whatever. And as I said, please feel free to ask anything you'd like. And remember what we said about all questions asked in good faith with a willingness to learn are valid questions. So there's obviously a lot of our story that we have not shared with you because for the constraints of time. But anyway, go ahead. Yeah.
In your churches, will gay men, lesbian women symbolically marry? Or, I mean, I don't believe they legally can. Mm. Couples, I mean.
Well, at St. Francis is about half heterosexual and half gay male and lesbian. Mm-hmm. And St. Francis has holy unions for gay men and for lesbians. And San Francisco just enacted domestic partners legislation so that gay male couples who are in a committed relationship and lesbian couples who are in a committed relationship can register at City Hall with the City of San Francisco and receive recognition of their partnerships. Phyllis and I have registered our partnership with the City of San Francisco.
Okay, that.
We have also had an affirmation of commitment celebration 5 years ago.
Now, are you saying that's within church?
Yes, at our church. Our church does holy unions
for
lesbians and gay men.
Yeah.
In terms of a historical perspective and other synods or churches, non-Catholic at least, have we had similar events can you fill me in on the historical record?
Yes.
For the last, 50 or whatever, 100 years, what are we talking about here?
Similar events in terms of ordination?
And this five-year penalty.
Mm. John Boswell, who is chair of the history department at Yale, is working right now on a book that I hope will be published within the next couple of years or so, roughly titled 1500 Years of Same-Sex Blessings in the Church, or Same-Sex Marriages in the Church, I'm not sure which. He has discovered ancient documents in the Vatican at Rome, which give clear evidence of the fact that the early Christian church married gay men and lesbians. In fact, gay men and lesbians were the first to have marriages in the early Christian church because heterosexual couples got married in civil law courts. And the whole origin of marriage in ancient Rome and Greece was for the purpose of transferring property rights because, you know, women didn't have the same status legally as men. So it was gay couples who came to the church and said, we would really like to have our unions in the church because these are unions of love rather than property distribution. And the church granted that. In the marriage rite that Boswell has uncovered in the Vatican Library, it's the same marriage rite for heterosexual couples later as for gay couples. The only difference is that the psalm used is different. The psalm for straight couples talks about God blessing their relationships with plentiful children. You may the fruit of the vine, you know, be abundant. And for
gay couples, it's how lovely and good that brothers can dwell together in harmony, or that sisters can dwell together in harmony. The couples, whether they were straight or gay or lesbian, would stand with their hands crossed together over the gospel, and their hands would be tied with ribbon as a symbol of their unity together and their unity with God. That will obviously stir up some controversy when it gets published.
What's significant, I think, about these findings of Boswell is that I was led to believe, and I bet most of us have been led to believe, that the phenomena of lesbian and gay people in the Christian church is a recent phenomena. In fact, it's so recent that it's only probably been happening within the last 10, 15, 20 at the most years. And that there have never been self-affirming lesbian and gay people in Christian tradition. That is in fact false. Not only have there have been lesbian and gay bishops, there have been gay male bishops, there have been rituals blessing lesbian and gay partnerships. It's important, I think, for all of us that we realize that somehow that history has been covered up, and that history is not being taught to any of us, and it's not being shared.
Mark, in terms of your question for some church history stuff, I'm blanking on the dates, but in the late 1970s for the Episcopal...
76 or 78.
Yeah. I think it was 78, I'm not sure. There were, I think it was 8 Episcopal women priests who were ordained. And that wasn't gay and lesbian, but that was the same sense of the church is not officially at a point in its rules that it would ordain. And so there was the same sort of lifting up from the people that happened at our ordinations. And so those were also irregular ordinations. And that happened about 8 years ago And that was a little different in that their bishop credenced that and was a part of that, and he was actually disciplined for that action. And then several years after those women were ordained, their ordinations were recognized as Episcopal Church began to ordain women. So there is some precedence for irregular ordination, that sort of action.
I think there was someone over here that was asking.
The question that popped into my mind, Jeff, after you commented on the change, how you went through the certification process in the LCA, and then things changed so much, boom, sort of blew out of the space. How do you account for that? Why do you think, what are the issues that contributed to this?
Actually, it's very easy, I think, to account for that. The publicity is what caused that to happen. Following the merger of the church and the formation of the ELCA, there was a lot of publicity that two of the predecessor bodies had ordained or had certified for ordination 3 openly gay men. There was publicity in the LA Times and many of the Washington papers, and the Lutheran even picked up on some stuff. Mm-hmm. Following that publicity, the gentleman's agreement that the bishops had and currently have regarding lesbian and gay clergy broke down, and they were no longer able to abide by that. That agreement says that if you're lesbian or gay, if you're an ordained person, you have to be quiet. You can share that with me if I'm supportive, and you could perhaps can share that with a few people in your congregation, but don't share that with many more than that. And that was impossible at that time. And so the 11 bishops from regions 1 and 2 got together and created a policy. And they said, well, are you practicing? And we said, what do you mean, are we practicing? And they called us to a meeting, and they said, well, we want you to... And they asked us if we were currently practicing homosexuals or if we ever planned to be practicing homosexuals. And we asked them to define what they meant by practicing, and they said, well, erotic behavior. That's what we're talking about. And they wouldn't be more specific. We went through a laundry list of same sexual activities. And we asked them to tell us whether or not this or this or this was practicing. Was that an example of same-sex erotic behavior? And all they didn't have a response after this list. Their mouths were just kind of open. That people would talk so explicitly about sexual activity, but they didn't want to define it. We simply couldn't do it. And the reason for that change is the publicity.
I think that's really important to point out that it actually isn't a change.
It's
a consistent viewpoint that as long as people do not publicly let anyone know what it is that they're doing in private, then the bishops will tolerate this.
The change is only in terms of the formality of the policy. We have now entered an era in the church where the level of formality has exceeded that of any prior denomination regarding the ordination of lesbian and gay persons. We have never had a policy like we have now. Yeah, front right here. Oh.
I think we heard the last one was a woman, right?
I'm sorry.
In the interest of gender parity, I wanted to alternate.
Are you angry with God because you're different than the 90%, or is this homosexuality a challenging gift?
Is there anyone in particular you want to have respond to that?
Well, I think it's a very good question, because my image of God has changed very much as I have come to accept myself and see the worth of my life and the worth of my life as a sexual person. I think I was angry at God a good part of my life, and I think that had to do with feeling different and alienated in my family and in the world. So I think I really felt that alienation in terms of anger toward God. And now I think some people find it hard to believe, but if there were a magic pill that I could take that I would now be heterosexual, 10 years ago, I probably would have said yes. I'm quite sure I probably would have said yes. But now I wouldn't. I mean, it really has become a gift for my life, and I think my experience of God and the world is far richer because that's true for me. That's who I am, and it can be a real gift. I think we struggle so much with difference, and as we look in this room racially as Lutherans, we know that we struggle with difference. And so I think it's the beginning of a resource for what is the role of difference in the world. So I really think it is a gift that I have been able to accept and I'm very grateful for now.
Actually, I am at peace with God in a way that I never was when I couldn't accept myself. And so I'm not at all angry with God for being lesbian. I'm grateful that I have come to be able to see this as a natural part of creation. The pill that Phyllis referred to, if there was a pill that I could give our society that would change society's attitudes towards gay and lesbian people, I would love to give that pill to society. But I don't want to change my life. I'm extremely happily partnered with Phyllis. I'm involved in very meaningful work and feel the responsibility and the opportunity of the call to ministry that I have been privileged to carry. I couldn't be happier with my life. But it does get tiring to have to keep trying to educate other people, and it gets tiring to be professional lesbians. I said to Phyllis the other day, do you suppose we'll ever be asked to speak on anything other than homosexuality for the rest of our lives? Yeah, and that's hard. But it goes with the territory.
Yes.
I have heard rumors that two students were recently dismissed from the seminary in St. Paul after having been at your congregation or one of your churches, and I'm wondering if this is true, and if it is, if it's because of what they said, or what happened, or because they came there, or what.
I think what you're referring to is the case of one seminarian who used to go to Lutheran Northwestern Seminary and now is currently a student at Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary. Mm-hmm. His case we will be talking about in part of our series called Homophobia in the ELCA. It's a complex case, so I need to defer your question, or maybe we can talk about it outside. But yes, that is happening.
On Saturday, we'll talk about that.
Yeah.
This does not have to do with...
Was there, before we go to another woman, was there a man that was raising his hand? Okay.
Is there a man out there?
I'm wondering, what specifically were the church's grounds for not accepting you as homosexuals, and what your responses to those questions were? I mean, their biblical concerns, or their historical concerns, or, and what exactly were they facing?
You mean in terms of the congregations going on trial and all of that?
Yeah, what were they, and what were their...
It wasn't biblical, it wasn't traditional, it wasn't behavior. The grounds that they gave were simply that we broke the Constitution. That we were in violation of the Constitution, in that the Constitution says that one of the requirements for a congregation is that you call according to the procedure that they give. And Ruth and Jeff and I, at one time I was on the group, on that roster, but I am no longer, I was no longer on that roster. And so they called, those two congregations called persons who were not on the official clergy roster or those available for call. And so it was because of a violation of the Constitution. So, I mean, it is a sense of, I think what that illustrates to me is that we think that we're often talking about important matters of biblical interpretation and the heart of the gospel and, you know, the core of what we preach and fidelity to our God. And hopefully that's all a part of the life of an institution somewhere. But in terms of policies and in terms of how, well, as I see it, in terms of how the mechanism of oppression works, you know, it can just be this constitutional hoop that then you're out. I mean, so I don't mean to minimize what goes into all of us forming a constitution and all of that, and yet it seems very ironic that it wasn't for any kind of those deeper violations.
We were all certified at one time for parish ministry. We were all deemed fit candidates for parish ministry. Jeff was decertified, or his was put on hold. And Phyllis asked to be taken off the roster because she came out to her bishop and told him she was in a committed relationship with me. And so her name was removed. And then I allowed my certification to lapse after that little encounter with the bishop in the gay pride parade. And I realized I couldn't go ahead with ministry. So, but the catch-22 is that the congregations are never going to be able to call an openly lesbian or gay pastor, because an openly lesbian or gay pastor is never going to be on that roster. And the threat, I think, that gay men and lesbians are to the church is that we confront the church with the whole issue of human sexuality, which has been a taboo subject. Because clearly, our relationships of love and commitment are not for the purpose of procreation, but for the purpose of a bond, for the purpose of intimacy and connection and vulnerability and trust. I mean, that's what our sexual expression is about. It's not about having children. And we have a tradition that has developed a whole theology of sexuality based solely on the traditional understanding of the nuclear family, and that sexual expression is for the purpose of having children, and if you have sexual expression for other reasons, you shouldn't really talk about it, and you probably shouldn't enjoy it too much. And so there's a lot of shame that attends human sexuality in the church. We've got a job to do in the church to address all that shame and to help our children grow up without all kinds of shame messages around their sexuality, whether they are straight children or lesbian or gay children.
You're making such a difference with talk about lesbian and gay children. Don't you think there is a sliding scale that people don't necessarily know from the beginning what they are? Some people,
sure.
I mean, if it was allowed, I'm sure people would love anybody or whatever. I don't think it's a sort of traditional, a sort of behavior that is society has forced upon people that they should behave in a certain way, and if they don't. And I think it's very important what you said about shame in sexuality as a whole, that even all types of sexuality mm-hmm. are in the church setting, there is a sort of dubious.
Sure.
Mm. Even like young people who want to live together or whatever, it's difficult and so, well.
Yeah, I don't think we can talk about sexuality in terms of neat boxes, you know, straight, gay, and I think sexuality is a continuum of expression.
Because it yeah. wouldn't be a threat mm-hmm. if it was that simple, that mm-hmm. 10% are gay or lesbian mm-hmm. and the rest are straight, and then, well, mm-hmm. leave those 10% alone. And
think about, though, what kind of society it would be if kids growing up as they were entering adolescence and discovering who they were sexually, if they could date either persons of the same sex or persons of the opposite sex. Now it is totally unthinkable in our society for boys to date boys and girls to date boys. Think about the
girls
type of...
Date girls.
I'm sorry, what did I say?
We know you like
yes,
boys,
yes,
that's true.
Right. Think about what kind of society it would be if people, as they're struggling with their own sexuality, if they could try to work that out, it would be very different, and it would be very liberating. That would be a society which would then, from a very early stage, encourage people to pursue relationships of love and fidelity and faithfulness and commitment, whether or not those were heterosexual or homosexual relationships. Right now, people have to come out, and I long for the day when lesbian and gay kids no longer have to come out, when their process of coming out is the same process that heterosexual youth sitting or going through that same process with them are going through. Mm-hmm. But right now, that's not the case.
This issue with the church, I think, is by far more political than it is biblically, doctrinally based. Mm. And the fact that it was publicity that threw a monkey wrench into the thing underlines the fact that there is so much homophobia out there that they can't risk doing this because they will lose members and lose support and all of that. I think it's kind of sad when it gets down to almost a purely political kind of thing. And the homophobia, I don't know how you're going to address that, because it's such an emotional issue that once I've made up my mind that you're bad, and you better straighten up, or you're out, you know. Then for my church to okay you to be ordained is just unthinkable. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't agree with that, but I think that the very high percentage of the Lutheran membership is in that bag. Mm-hmm. And that it has been judged already that this is bad, this is wrong, we cannot do this one. Mm-hmm. I don't know what they plan or what they think should happen to this 10%, because they really feel that if you just make up your mind, sweetie, you can change. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. If we have 5.3 million members in the ELCA, you can figure out what 10% of that is. And you can figure out what the messages are that we are sending to this significant, very significant minority in our denomination.
I think it's also important to remember that coming out is not only the experience of gay and lesbian people, it's the experience of our families. Mm-hmm. Because if my mother knows that she's attending a church where her daughter would not be welcome, what is that saying to her? You know? So we have created a church which has closeted enormous numbers of persons, not only gay and lesbian persons,
right.
but all their siblings and their parents. My, you know, the irony is that when I came out to my parents, they stepped into my closet. You know, they had to ask themselves, who can we talk to about this? Mm-hmm. Who can we get support from? And there are avenues for support, in case any of you are family members and want them. We can talk about them later.
It's
We're yeah. out of time.
We're out of time.
Thank you. We're going to end the tape. Thank you all for coming out tonight.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. That was one of the most happy
I think the most happy